Welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We hope you had a great weekend. Of course, it was a little bit too smoky for all of us, but we're glad that you're with us today. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we'll visit with author Bruce Campiglia. He joins Main Street to discuss the enduring power of books in a fast-paced digital world and emphasizes how immersive storytelling, especially for youth, can foster self-discovery, empathy, and memory in ways short-form content can't. And we begin Main Street today with Becky Eisinger. She's a child and adolescent psychotherapist at Essentia Health. Becky, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you.
First, Becky, before we get into what you do, what is a pediatric psychotherapist or a child and adolescent psychotherapist?
We are a licensed mental health professional, and the population that we serve are children and adolescents. So I can see kids as young as three, but usually they're around four or five, and then I'll see them through their 18th birthday if they continue in high school. And then after they graduate high school, we look at transitioning to an adult provider.
When I think of assistance for mental health, I've always thought of adults who need assistance for mental health. And then relative to school, I thought of school counselors. Mm-hmm. But here we have you. So tell me, Becky, what do you see in your practice? What are some of the most common mental or behavioral health challenges that you see in the age group that you serve? And I've got to believe that it's different from a kindergartner through a sophomore in high school.
Sure. Common to see anxiety, common to see depression, common to see ADHD, as well as, unfortunately, a lot of trauma work too.
Would you say that you have been busier post-COVID? Have you thought about that?
It's remained pretty consistent. Yeah, we were strictly virtual during COVID, and so doing Zoom visits, which was interesting with kindergartners, but we did it. And when they could transition back into the office, it seemed to be pretty seamless. So
it must be easy for some young people to develop a connection with you, and then harder for others.
Yes.
When you first visit with someone, how do you do that?
I like to establish relationship, and I like to do that in the first visit, the first few minutes. I like to welcome kids into the room. Usually parents are with them. That makes them feel a little bit more comfortable. I let them know what is going to happen in the first visit and what therapy is like, what they can expect. And I invite them to play with any of the toys, any of the fidgets, any of the art supplies, so that they can familiarize themselves and feel comfortable. And a lot of times if they're busy doing something, it's easier to get comfortable because it's not so intimate.
I want to describe your office to our listeners, and I think that I'm in a Toys R Us aisle or something similar to that, but it has a purpose.
It does. One of the main modes of therapy that I use, especially with younger kids, usually about from 4 till sometimes 11, 10 or 11, is play therapy. And there are a number of different ways and methods for that. I tend to look at child-centered or non-directive. That seems to be what I gravitate towards, but there are certainly times where I might need to use a directed approach and direct the play to develop skills or talk about feelings or talk about coping with feelings, those sorts of things. But most of the time, kids come in with their own agenda. They know what they want to work through. Play therapy works well for younger kids because they don't have the language skills that older kids or adults have. And their language is play. And we can work through a number of different concerns through their play and tracking their play, reflecting back what they're doing, those sorts of things.
How do young people find you? In other words, what brings them to you? I'm wondering whether parents have a different vision for their child's mental health than their adolescent teenager might believe their mental health is, or the state of their mental health is, and there could be some friction there, I would assume.
Oh yeah, I most of my referrals come from within the Essentia network. most often pediatrician or primary care or family care.
A parent, let's go there a little further. So a parent might be in a consultation with their family physician and say, my life is X, Y, and Z, but I have these issues with my children. Is that how it begins?
It typically can. Usually it's identified in the yearly well child checks. But sometimes parents will just schedule with their provider because they do have concerns about their kid's anxiety or difficulty regulating emotions or difficulty with behaviors in school or in the home. And so a lot of times parents will reach out to the provider and then the provider refers to me and we get the ball rolling.
I'm wondering too if sometimes as you visit with children, is the problem not the child but the adult in their lives? And how do you deal with that?
I don't like to demonize parents because I do think they're doing the best that they can with the skills that they have. And so I like to align myself with the parent as well to support them so that they can support their child. But yes, sometimes consistency with implementing various strategies or interventions. Two-parent households, quite frequently, both parents might have differing parenting styles, and that can be confusing for kids. And so a lot of education, teaching, supporting parents through that process. I do parent-only visits, where parents can come in and kind of talk about what their concerns are, what their frustrations are, and we can work through some of those challenges with parents rather than taking time from the child's therapy session. So,
what are some early signs that a child might benefit from your services, Becky, from seeing a behavioral health professional?
Typically, there is difficulty regulating emotions, very strong reactions to being told no or being asked to pick up your toys.
Isn't that just part of being a kid, maybe, and testing the boundaries between child and parent that we sometimes see, or in my case, child and grandparent?
Yes. And so that's kind of what we have to parse out. Is this what you would expect at a particular developmental stage, or is it a little beyond what you would expect? They're having a little bit more trouble than what you would expect at that developmental stage.
I often think, Becky, those of us here in the Fargo area are lucky because there are folks like you and there are specialists around, but that's not the case necessarily in rural North Dakota. Am I accurate with that statement?
You are. I see right now I am the only pediatric provider for Essentia. We do have a couple in Detroit Lakes and we have somebody in Jamestown who sees kids as well, but my practice is solely focused on kids. And so I'll get kids referred from Jamestown, from Detroit Lakes, from Ada, Twin Valley. Yeah. And sometimes parents can bring them in. And if they can't, then we do virtual visits.
I'm wondering if there are parents who are listening who are thinking, but it's a sign of failure if I need to have help from you. It's a sign of weakness or something about me that makes me feel that I want to bring my kid for help and I've failed.
That's a common theme with and a concern for parents.
What do you tell those parents?
Well, I kind of compare it to if your child has a sore throat, you're probably going to go in to the walk-in or your pediatrician because you don't know as a parent, is it strep throat? Is it just a sore throat? What do they need, right? You can't take care of those things on your own. Or if your kid falls off their bike and breaks their arm, away we go to get it, you know, cast. So parents can't do that on their own. And so the mental health is really no different, but that is a pretty significant barrier, is that stigma around mental health and failure as a parent.
People bring their children to you, Becky, and is an answer they may get from you is, you know what, things aren't as bad as you think. You're on a pretty good line here.
Yeah, and that oftentimes just that reassurance is helping families see what their strengths are, what their successes are, the things that they're doing are having an impact. It's not going to change overnight. Healing is not linear. We'll see progress and then we hit a bump in the road and we have a setback and then we can kind of continue and assisting parents with understanding that that's all part of the whole parenting gig.
When you mention the word healing, to me it means that that implies there has been a specific trauma. But I have to believe that's not necessarily the case. It could just be life has brought us here.
Yes. Yes.
Can you talk more about causations that you see other than significant traumas?
With ADHD, it's a neurological disorder, so it's how a person's brain is wired. And in kids, they don't have those, we call them executive functions, right? Those impulse control, tolerating frustration, planning ahead, remembering things. Kids aren't great at that baseline, right? But if we have somebody with ADHD, that's really difficult. And regulating those emotions and being easily frustrated and maybe not getting along with peers and not understanding how to get along with peers. And so sometimes that'll bring kids in. Or anxiety. Kids are withdrawn. They're always worrying. They're not sleeping. They're not eating. Grades are suffering. Relationships are suffering. And that oftentimes brings kids in too.
We're enjoying our conversation with Becky Eisinger. She's a child and adolescent psychotherapist at Essentia Health, and she's based in Fargo. Back to the thought that dealing with five-year-olds is different than dealing with teenagers. How do you approach therapy first for that teenager who may be defiant in their world at the time?
Yeah, and I let them know that I don't move at a pace that they're not comfortable with. One of the things that I tell kids and families straight out the first visit is when kids have had enough of their session, they've had enough, and they're free to leave if they want to at that point. Most of the time, kids, especially during the school year, they don't want to go back to school, so they'll hang out and we'll find some kind of an activity to do. And that is that building that relationship, which goes so far in helping kids kind of overcome whatever it is they're struggling with.
You are certified in trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yes.
What is that? And how does this form of therapy help young people process and recover from a trauma event?
It's a very structured, time-limited approach, and it is only one tool working with trauma. We focus on identifying thoughts and feelings, and then how do we cope with those thoughts and feelings? And then we start to get into the trauma, and kids will develop a trauma narrative. And we go slow with that if we need to, because quite often it's triggering. And we need to practice those skills. We need to have those coping strategies so we can regulate those emotions and those behaviors when those pop up for us. As we go through the process, they are more and more able to talk about their trauma experiences, and it's not always talking about them. Some kids will write. I have some kids who will draw. I have some kids who will use sand tray to illustrate their trauma narrative. And it gets easier and easier each time they are exposed to that. And they come to understand that I can take care of this. I can regulate my emotions and behaviors. It's okay to feel the way I'm feeling given what my experience was.
There may be some parents listening who remember their youth thinking, well, I didn't have to go see someone like her and I got through it okay. I did just fine. Why do I need to take my child in to see a professional?
Yeah.
How would you respond?
I get that frequently. And if a parent doesn't feel like it's necessary, then okay, that's fine. We're not going to force it. However, I do believe that there are different stressors and demands on kids now compared to, say, their parents. And yes, it was the old pull yourself up by your bootstraps and just do it, right? But I do think that there was a lot of community support, extended family support in those situations, which is not necessarily and frequently is not the case with our families today. They're more isolated. Extended family isn't around for support. Grandma doesn't live two blocks down and can come over and watch the kids so mom can run to Walmart without having to deal with temper tantrums and, you know, all the things. So I do think that that's a huge difference, is that support and community.
I must believe, Becky, that with young teens, cell phones come into the discussion at some point or another.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts?
I know that they are oftentimes necessary. Kids are really busy. They are in a lot of activities and need to maintain contact with parents. But I do think there needs to be some limits. And I do think that there is an appropriate age for kids to start having a phone. I would recommend, and there's a lot of research out now about this very thing, if your child needs a phone because they're traveling with their basketball team or whatever, flip phone is just fine. They don't need to have a smartphone.
I'm going to miss out. My friends all have them.
Yep.
I'm going to miss out.
Yep. And yes, true. But it also comes with that they can't get away from it. And it is almost, research is telling us, it is an addiction. And I see tons, not just cell phones, but access to screens, YouTube, video games. Getting kids off of those is difficult. They don't want to quit playing because the endorphins that are released, right? And the dopamine rush that they have.
So do you actually have an age recommendation that a person might be ready for a cell phone?
I know it's not going to be a popular recommendation, but I really don't know that kids need to have access to a smartphone much before or at all before middle school. And they're just not equipped to handle that onslaught of information overload.
Middle school surprises me a little bit when you say that. I thought for sure you would say their freshman year in high school or their junior year in high school.
And that would be ideal. But if they do need a phone, flip phone in middle school would be my recommendation.
All right, let's go back to what it is that we are talking about today. Tell me more about OtPlay and how it helps children with autism and ADHD.
OtPlay is a specific approach to play therapy, working with kids who are on the autism spectrum. When social skills are difficult, relating to people is difficult. And so it's a very child-centered approach. Whatever the child is interested in, that's what we go with, whatever they're willing to do in a visit. Sometimes it might be just we sit and we shoot suction cup Nerf guns at the poster on the wall, and that gets them to be more comfortable with that relationship and interacting and those social skills. So OtPlay is designed to target those specific needs.
I'm guessing some parents come to you and say, fix this. Mm-hmm. I can go get that cast and I know the bone will be fixed in 4 to 6 weeks. Fix this now.
Yeah, it doesn't happen overnight. And there's not a quick fix for it. It is a lifelong effort for parents.
Give us some tips on how parents or even caregivers can create a home environment that really promotes emotional safety and mental wellness. This is parenting 101 maybe, or 102.
Well, no, I don't know. Acknowledging what kids are feeling, validating that, not dismissing that. What's a big deal to a kid is not necessarily a big deal to an adult. Like somebody didn't want to play with me on the playground today and my feelings got hurt and now I'm crabby and I'm sad. That's a big deal to an elementary age kid. Breaking up with a significant other in middle school or high school, that's a big deal. To an adult, it's like, yeah, been there, done that, right? But in their world, in their kid brain, it's a big deal. And so validating that and understanding that, helping them sort through and name their emotions. Parents oftentimes want to fix for kids. And so I'll coach parents and kids to, do you want your parent to help you fix this? Or do you want your parent just to listen and to clarify that? So that a lot of times that helps.
Families have their ups and downs through life, Becky, and there are times where divorce or grief, loss of a loved one, a close family member perhaps, or some other stressor. Parents, I think, often try to protect their kids from some of those events. Is that wise, and how should they do it?
I'm not sure that protect would be the term I would use. Certainly they want to spare their children from that experience, right? And from feeling that emotional pain. But they need to experience that to know how to work through that and develop those skills. And
we've heard the adage that kids always know what's going on. Generally true?
Yeah, they have a sense. If they don't know specific, they kind of know, yeah, something's up, right? The house is tense. Mom and dad are behaving differently, right? Yeah.
So then as a parent, we've made it a tough decision to split perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Again, how should we handle that with our kids?
Honesty and information at a developmentally appropriate level and maintaining that child-parent boundary. There are certain things that kids, no matter how old they are, don't need to know about parents' relationships. And so that needs to stay out of it.
Dad lost his job. Mom lost her job. Those are tough times for families.
Yes.
So you're recommending honesty is best?
Yeah, at a developmentally appropriate level.
As we kind of wind things up, I'm a parent and I want to have my child be emotionally resilient, to have a great foundation to deal with life's ups and downs. How can I best help them become resilient, yet still empathetic?
I think that helping kids develop a portfolio, if you will, of successes where they have been able to go through something that's been difficult for them. And it was hard and it was not fun, but I had it in me. I had the inner wealth. I had that strength that I could get through that. And if we keep building those experiences, keep putting those experiences in that portfolio, that continues to build that resilience.
Becky, we hear a lot today about kids being bullied and harassed, and perhaps that's via social media or other means. It seems to me we hear more of that today than we did 20 years ago or so. A, is that true? And B, how can kids handle that?
It does seem like we are having an increase in situations where kids are bullied or picked on. And it's not just, it used to be name calling on the playground, right? And then when you left school, that was that. Then we got into the burn book. And so then that gets circulated. And with the advent of smartphones and social media platforms, kids, they can't get away from that now that we have smartphones and social media platforms, and they want to keep their phones in their room at night because they want, and they'll keep looking at them all night because they want to know, what am I walking into the next day at school? What do I need to steel myself against? What do I need to prepare myself for? So they're losing sleep because of it. They're being influenced by not just peers that they see in person, but internet personalities. Yeah, it's a tough one.
You in favor of the bell-to-bell cell phone ban in North Dakota schools?
Yes.
Should parents have an 8 p.m. to 7 a.m. cell phone ban at home?
I recommend parents have screen time, and it gets shut off at a certain time, and then it gets turned on again at a certain time. And I leave that up to parents to decide what's most appropriate for their kid.
Becky, do you ever have kids come to you saying, my parents are on my back about doing X, Y, or Z, and they want me to be really good at it, whether it's the quarterback or the piano player or the debater, and I don't like it. I want to do A, B, or C.
Right.
Yeah. Do you see that in your practice?
I do. And then it's like a conversation to help kids figure out, when do you want to talk to your parent about that? How do you want to talk to your parent about that? Do you want to do that in here with support? Yeah.
Can that go okay?
Sometimes, not always. Yeah.
My guest has been Becky Eisinger. She's a child and adolescent psychotherapist at Essentia Health. Becky, if people want to learn more about emotional wellness for their children, how can they do that?
There's a ton of resources on the internet, right? There are resources specific to kids in anxiety or kids in depression or kids with ADHD. I have a number of resources that I share with parents. There are a number of books that I'll share, or chapters in books that I'll share with parents. That's what I would encourage.
Thank you for joining us on Main Street.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Still to come on Main Street, St. Paul-based author Bruce Campiglia stops by. He'll talk about books for kids in a fast-paced world. Stay with us. Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Main Street continues today with Bruce Campiglia. He's the author of the Light Passers series and a passionate voice for the power of the written word. In this age of scrolling, swiping, and short attention spans, Bruce reminds us that books still matter, maybe now more than ever. From neuroscience to book talk, he explores why stories still shape who we are, how we think, and where we're going. Bruce is visiting with us from St. Paul, and welcome, Bruce, to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig. Good to be here.
Let's wind up the Wayback Machine and tell our listeners what started your personal connection with books and what role did they play in your life growing up?
I've always loved to write. I liked to write when I was in college. I took my electives in writing, creative writing, and I tried writing while I was away traveling around the world. I spent a lot of time in the Middle East and Japan and all over the place. But then I started novels, but I never really finished anything. I never kept any. I just got busy with life and had kids and raised a family. And then I started a nonprofit for kids, health, basically teaching them yoga and meditation and things like that at Boys and Girls Clubs. And I started getting the idea. I loved kids those ages. Like the heroes in my books are 15 to 17 years old, and some of them even younger. But I felt that this was a period in time when I sort of got lost. I felt that by sort of using them as the heroes, we can find ourselves again and they can find themselves and take people forward. And so I had the idea of writing one novel to sort of explain that and deal with. Basically, I love history, so history and spirituality, different spiritualities, and basically anything that like mystery, adventure. Well, these are the books that I liked when I was a kid. And so that sort of got me thinking about it. And during my time when I was head of the nonprofit, or I co-founded, I started to write. But it was a long process to learn, though. So that's how I got started. But boy, I'll tell you, it's been quite the roller coaster.
Do you think you'd be a different writer, Bruce, had you been writing as a career for a long, long time versus starting to write after you were, about 50-ish or so?
Yeah, I think for me personally, yeah, absolutely. And I think that because I like to take a lot of information and sort of distill it down and then try to make it something creative out of it. And I think it takes me a lifetime to gather that information through experiences, through my travels, through all the things that I've done. And I've taken a lot of risks and failed a lot. So failure is always important. Everybody will tell you that. And it's very important to fail. And I learned from all that and tried to consolidate that information that I had to be a value to kids or adults, whoever.
Your Light Passer series blends imagination and deeper themes. How do you hope it connects with those readers today who are used to getting everything they need, they think, in 15 or 30 seconds?
I know. It's a dilemma. But I think part of the problem is that there's so much information, there's so much stress, everything that's going on there with the phones. And of course, now we have AI, which is just going to be another wild card in this whole thing. But it overstimulates everybody. And so nobody has any time. You find out now even adults are having less and less time. And I'm supposed to be sort of retired, but I have no time because of the writing, all the things that catch up with technology. So, yeah, they have there's no time that they have to really devote to something. I find that in some of the research I've done and looking at how kids read and all that, They do. They're still reading. They're still reading books, just like we were when we were younger. And there's more and more books out there, so it's hard to have a small number of books be great sellers and apply to everybody. But kids are reading. They may read different things. They may read graphic novels when they're younger. They may read fantasy, light fantasy or romance as they're getting a little bit older. But the genre are actually still similar. Books are still important. They're still selling more, even though there's split into different target audiences. So it's still there. The problem was, like I say, how do you get them to focus on reading a novel, full novel or whatever? And I think there's two things there. One is storytelling. It's all, to me, all about storytelling. So through history, everybody would listen to a story. It started with tribes, you know, and then you had the cuneiform, then you had the papyrus, and you had print, and now videos. So, but all of those different media and formats rely on storytelling. That's how people got information. That's how they passed on the information generation to generation. And I just don't see that that's really changed a whole lot. The point is to be a good storyteller, because people love to listen to stories, and whether they're reading it or listening to it. But it is important, I think, to formulate that storytelling. How do you want to tell the story? And then make it interesting enough that they can get something out of it. Because everybody likes to escape, you know, when you listen to a story. That's part of it. You're escaping. That's why fantasy is so big these days. But you can overdo it, and you can overdo the fantasy, and then you're completely lost and you're getting nothing out of anything in terms of learning anything. So I think it's the storytelling and how to guide them through that and make the characters alive, make it something they can identified with.
Is there neuroscience at the base of all of this that tells us how our brain reacts to reading books versus just scrolling and whipping through things at 100 miles an hour?
I have come across things over the years, and my own experience with readers and myself is you can't remember the information, which is very important in carrying it forward. If you're going to learn, like you were asking about, how do you get lessons from these things? How do you take things forward and make better decisions or whatever you're going to do from books instead of just doing nothing or doing the wrong thing? And I think that's partly remembering. You have to remember these lessons. And the engagement in a book is different than anything else, because you're flipping back and forth and you're developing those neural networks. And the same thing, it's true also, even more so with the younger you are, because you have more of those neurons to connect or to reconnect, which, you know, mine are slowly fading.
I'm right there with you, by the way.
Yeah, the pathways that they get formed, but there's still more there for everybody. But I think that the importance is the remembering. And the books do the tactile feel, the fact that you're going back and forth, you're searching things, you're picking it up, you're putting it down. It's something that the people will tell you. That tactile feel, the sticking it on the shelf, the taking it out, the placing it on your lap, the calming of your mind. These all have factors in the ability for you to understand the material and then to remember it. And whereas, you know, digital books are a little less effective than that. Audio books are tough because sometimes, I love audiobooks, but you lose your space, then you can go back in it, but you don't have the facility to jot back and forth and look at a cast of characters that might be in the beginning of the book, all those types of things. So I think that enables you, books, novels in particular, longer books, enable you to remember more, get more information in there, get more information out of there, which you can't do in other media, particularly video, which is a passive experience. And I know now it's not just my age that I can't remember as much anymore. I know that when I was younger, I watch a movie, I forget it. And I couldn't remember the details, the characters, the actors' names or anything like that, you know? So, but I can remember books. I remember, you know, the early books that, you know, the Lord of the Rings was one of my favorite books growing up. There are lessons in the Lord of the Rings. It's a part fantasy, but I remember that, reading that when I was younger. I remember even reading Dickens stories when I was younger. That's how old I am. But I think that's part of the whole thing you're getting at, I guess.
Yeah. Let me ask you this question, Bruce. Okay. I'm showing you a phone in my hand. And I think there are some who would argue that, hey, I've got access, like you said earlier, to everything I need right here. I don't need books. And they may be becoming obsolete in education. What would you tell someone who has that perspective?
I think that I look at it like, yeah, if you're trying to gather facts, quick facts, to have a discussion with somebody or something like that, yeah, you can look it up, you can Google it, you can flash it to somebody else, you can text it, you can do all these things. But it's a matter of, in your own life, how do you order the importance of things? How do you gain experience from somebody else's experience? And that type of thing. I see that. In fact, it's an interesting question you asked that, because I look at everything right now, like I've only been in the business like 14 years, but I've been through the whole thing. Like when it was traditional, when you really had to get an agent, you had to get a publisher, you had to do all the things in the right order. And now it's flipped a little bit. It's hard for writers. They have to be business people. They have to get out there and market. You got to learn technology. But I do feel that it's something that I've learned over the years, that the change is fast. It makes you lose your place. These things are changing so fast, and you don't retain anything, and you don't learn. One of the things that's happened to me just recently is that I had the book series, The Light Pastor's Chronicles, out. Now, the first book took 10 years, which tells you something. A lot of learning in every aspect there. Then the last two, about a year and a half apart. And they're regular novels. They have fantasy, adventure, mystery in them, and stuff like that. And they're basically for everybody. But it's hard to market them because people have short attention spans. You can do it. I'm finding out that there's another way to push information out there, too, that might be what the type of information that you're talking about, not just facts, but learning something important from short subjects. And that is, I started a newsletter about it, you know, 2 months ago. And you can do that. This is like through Substack. But you can get information pushed out that way. It still is more traditional. It's short, but it's impactful. It can be impactful. And you can do it that way. And you can do it through other ways. And if you wanted to tie in, like we tie in a store, a Shopify store, where there's wearable things. So we have messages in the books that are valuable. You can put the messages in the Substack too. And you can reinforce it by having people be part of your experience, wear something, wear a t-shirt that has some meaning to it, like kindness or something like that. You can do it that way. And one last thing on top of all that is, as far as the message goes, a meaningful message in short subjects, on my Substack, I have a section called Notes from Nono. Now, Nono is an Italian word, which means grandfather. And the notes are short. They're short notes. I have a little introductory, but I have like a lesson in there. One of the first posts I ever did was recently for that was about the death of our family dog. It was a dog that I used to go hiking with all the time. She lived to be about 10 years old. And all that, my grandkids, I have 5 grandkids, and they love the dog. And of course, I have 3 daughters and they love the dog too. So Lola, it was about Lola. And it was a note. I do these sort of handwritten type of looking notes to 2 grandkids. So the parents or the grandparents can read these notes to their kids, to their grandkids. And it's about that. It's about, isn't she a friend? What did you learn from her? Aren't they dedicated? Don't they have unconditional love? These types of things. So you can do it. It's difficult. I still like the novels.
We're enjoying our conversation today with Bruce Campiglia. He's the author of the Light Passers series, and he's joining us from St. Paul. Bruce, you and I have maybe a little too much gray hair. So for you, how do you approach writing for a younger generation? These young people who are growing up in a fast-paced digital world that is just so different from ours.
Yeah, good question. I think, kids are smart, first of all. And they get nuance. They get, if you're even a writer that's not of the same nationality they are or ethnic background or whatever. And I try to do it through diversity so that everybody can sort of understand it. That's one of the big things. The other thing is they all have flaws. Each one of them has a different type of flaw. I have four main characters that are from different nationalities. One's a Lakota Sioux girl. They're all 15 to 17 years old. A black kid from Detroit who lives in the city. Kylie, who's from Hong Kong, Asia, you know, China. And then Leah, who's from Palestine. And they have different things. They're afraid of different things. They have unique fears, unique way that they look, unique spiritual backgrounds. Yet, and they're struggling to find themselves. I tried to make it so these kids that age need to look inward first. They're all confused because we go through life, and in the first 15 years, we've been bombarded by our parents, by our friends, by the schools, by the coaches. You know, we're dizzy, and then once you get in past that, you're starting your career, you're starting your relationships, you're building a family, and that's why it's so late. Lots of times when people try to look and find out, well, who the hell am I anyway? You know, and so I look at it like, okay, here, let's present these kids. They're diverse. There are these age groups that people are that even adults can identify with, because I think everybody can realize that they were pretty confused at that age. And then let's get them to be someplace together in some weird way, and then have them have to survive, get their way out as a team, find out what their weaknesses are, have them help the other, you know, focus on the other. And then that's how you're going to find yourself when you do that. And then you take that message forward.
So is that in a roundabout way the advice that you would give to parents who want to ignite or reignite the love for reading in their kids?
Yeah, I think, you know, well, I guess there's a couple of things. One is, yeah, I think if people read these books, they'll see, because they're like the books you had as a child that at an age like that, that were totally meaningful to you. Yet they have a little bit of fantasy in them. So they're fun. They're exciting. You know, they're not preachy and that type of thing. I think that kids still need that, just like you and I did.
So someone grabs one of your books and they read one or two. What are you hoping in the end they take away from the Light Chasers series that, as you said before, that will maybe stay with them?
I think to write more books and to have, I think the longer you establish a character that somebody identifies with, it's like Harry Potter. They continue to look at the character. They're buying the books for the characters and finding out what the next stage of the character is. It's not about the lesson itself or that particular story, that particular version of whatever you're trying to tell them. I think it's an evolution like that. And you get an affinity for that type of thing. And I'm trying to also influence it from the other way too, because they take these messages to put on Substack and all that.
What's next for you, Bruce?
Well, I'm looking at finishing the series in a way, because the book series is a mini series right now. I brought the characters into reality, a real based situation in Palestine and Israel, trying to tie those kids together there. And then, but each of the four kids, I want to do a special book for them and use different topics about living and life, like the technology because of the Kylie in China, and what does that mean to the world? What kind of arcs of history and sociology, what does that bring into play? How do his friends help him in that situation? So you're learning history, learning a lot of different things through the series.
My guest has been Bruce Campiglia. He's the author of the Light Passers series, reminding us that even in a world of endless scrolling, stories still have the power to slow us down, maybe shape our minds a little bit and stir our souls. Whether in print or pixels, the right book at the right time can still change everything. And you can learn more about Bruce and his work at lightpassers.com. And maybe, just maybe, it's time to pick up that book you've been meaning to read. Bruce, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Greg.
This is Bird Note. Some bird names get right to the point, like the gray catbird. Found from Canada to Colombia, these songbirds make a call like a kitten's meow. And they are, you guessed it, gray. In fact, ornithologists have named many gray birds for their predominant hue. Yet some species received more colorful descriptors than others, like the slate-colored grosbeak, a dark gray forest bird of Central and South America. Or the silvered ant bird of the Amazon rainforest. The Plumbius vireo's name derives from the Latin word plumbum, meaning lead. The species is found in the western regions of the U.S. and Mexico, and their cool gray complexion helps set them apart from other vireos. The Glaucus gull and Glaucus tanager are named for the subtle light bluish tint of their feathers. In fact, botanists use the same word to describe plants with a waxy coating, like the gray gleam on succulent leaves and fresh grapes. Who knew birds come in so many different shades of gray? For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 2nd. Since pioneer days, the life of a North Dakota farm wife was often described as one of unrelenting hardship, drudgery, and isolation. On this date in 1930, the Bismarck Tribune announced plans for a sort of paradise for farm wives. Vacation camps with games, picnics, music programs, community singing, and recreation would be enjoyed in pleasant surroundings, where cooking, dishwashing, laundering, and other usual duties of the farm mother are taboo. The four-day summer camps were sponsored by the North Dakota Agricultural College, now NDSU, Extension Service, in cooperation with county agents. The goal was to give farm women a short vacation at a small cost, only $5 for everything. Anything but work was the motto the farm wives would follow during their stay. Husbands and children would be entertained on the last day of each camp, but until then, they were not allowed. Three camps were scheduled: Chautauqua Park in Valley City, where women would have tents, at Park River, the dormitories of the Walsh County Agricultural School were made available, and at Amadon, the old H.T. Ranch provided a scenic western getaway. Vacationers would spend their time resting and participating in recreational and enrichment activities led by extension workers and local people in charge of each camp. This was the third year of the vacation camps. About 50 farm wives had participated in each of the two camps during the previous 2 years. Finding the camps successful, organizers replicated the program at a third location. The H.T. Ranch was a new vacation camp in 1930. For those women who could get away to participate, the vacation camps must have seemed like quite a good deal. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lisa Erdrich. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Nicole's Fine Pastry and Cafe on 8th Street South in Fargo. Open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 8 p.m., offering small batch baked goods, house-made soups, and more, with a second location at Brewhalla. Learn more at nicolesfinepastry.com.
I think probably I am a joiner. I tend to believe in the ideals of community in the first place. I gravitate toward that part of the dial where maybe the rhetoric isn't designed to get me upset. Nobody's shouting at me on public radio. I don't believe in free rides, and because I partake of this and value it, I'm going to put some of my treasure back into it. The first reason for a sustaining membership is life is a mess. You know, I don't know about you, my life's a mess. Things get lost on my desk. I just feel better if I know that I'm doing what I think I ought to be doing, and it's happening automatically. You can call 800-359-4145 or just go online to prairiepublic.org.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll visit with environmental consultant John Ellingson and we'll talk about the recent 3.1 million gallon brine spill in Williams County and learn that brine spills are worse than oil spills. And he'll tell us why. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.